Welcome to this podcast from the Medical Journal of Australia. My name is Sam Hunt, the MJA's news and online editor. My special guest today is Associate Professor Jeffrey Louie. Associate Professor Louie is a clinical academic psychiatrist. He is also head of the Academic Unit of Psychiatry and Addiction Medicine at the Australian National University School of Medicine and Psychology in Canberra. Professor Louie, thank you for joining me.
Thanks very much for asking me to join, Sam.
Let's start by talking about the economic gain from investments in mental health. You wrote a piece recently for Insight Plus that the costs to the economy of mental health conditions far outweigh the costs of treatment.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. Together with Steve Robson, the president of the AMA, we wrote an article that outlined some of the concerns about the economic burdens relating to mental health, which were actually highlighted by the Productivity Commission, showing that figures from $40 to $70 billion Australian were attributable either through direct or indirect costs to the Australian economy from the burden of mental illness. And when I say burden, I'm not saying that people are a burden. The burden on people's health and well-being is the crucial issue from a health economic perspective, which is distinct from classical aspects of economics. And the ways in which this occurs are as a result of direct costs, which are health investments and health infrastructure, but also indirect costs. When people are unwell with mental illnesses, they're significantly out of their day-to-day lives and roles, including their occupation, caring for their families, and engaging society. This all has costs economically for them and their families. So these are the types of costs that accumulate. And also to organizations where we lose the expertise of people who have skills that are lost through their mental illness, causing days off from their role. And also the other consequences that can occur are because people are not able to hold employment or to work in caring roles and support, and I'm not judging that, I'm just saying that that's a core related to their illness, then they don't spend as much in the economy. They don't go on holidays, they don't go to have the other opportunities that we all take for granted in day-to-day life. So there are losses to the economy on that basis.
Yes, there are those costs of inaction in terms of both personal well-being and economic costs. But Jeffrey, it seems patients needing care are being let down by the system. What kind of change do you want to see?
Yeah, I think one of the things that is very important to help improve the system is to realize that we are still in the pandemic, and the pandemic has highlighted a whole host of human and infrastructural problems that we have with healthcare actually throughout the developed world. So we're seeing very similar problems in UK, France, Germany, Spain, Canada, USA. Very high income, very high standard of living, but we've got problems both in the demand on healthcare and the supply of healthcare. And these are another way in which the economic lens can help us understand the issues, because for health economics, we're trying to look at the allocation of scarce or finite resources. And the problem with the pandemic that exposed was that we had relative under-resourcing and understaffing for the types of care that the Australian public have come to expect. They expect the first-class, world-standard care, which we can provide, but we have lagged both with particularly workforce and also with infrastructure such as provision of beds and capacity. And that comes to one of the structural problems that occurred is in terms of what people witness as a hospital logjam. There's no clear capacity to support the people that need urgent care, and there's not the wraparound care for people that come out partly because of lack of infrastructure in terms of beds in hospital, which is crucial, but also because of lack of funding of relevant community services and knock-on effects of the privatization of the NDIS, which has led to fractionation and also difficulty for consumers and carers to navigate the social support space. So that fracturing has caused also a hospital exit block as well, because we can't easily support people to go back to live in their homes or indeed to go into aged care facilities. And that's another looming problem is in terms of support, because that comes back to the workforce issue. Because in many senses, in terms of nursing and other specialized capabilities, there will be and there is some competition between aged care facilities and healthcare facilities.
And tell me how that shortage of healthcare workers has impacted the psychiatry profession. It sounds like you're seeing such a strong demand for your services.
Yes, Sam. We have seen a huge demand that was documented during the pandemic, both particularly in the private sector, where people were accessing more services, particularly remotely, through video and telephone telepsychiatry. So people were seeing private psychiatrists with their Medicare reimbursement and then paying some out-of-pocket costs, which are not inconsiderable, to access care. And the expansion in services provided was of the order of about 14%. And people were working longer hours, psychiatrists and other healthcare workers were working longer hours. Plus, of course, during the pandemic, doctors and other healthcare workers couldn't really go anywhere, just like the rest of the population. So we were at work, working with people. So that's the explanation for the increased capacity, because people have said, well, how can you increase this capacity? But that still was a huge need. And there was a drop in the attendance initially in a lot of the public hospitals, but that's ramped up and particularly increased quite massively after the worst of the pandemic so far.
And it sounds like issues with the system are affecting people in your profession as well. My guest today is Associate Professor Louis, a clinical psychiatrist in Canberra. Jeffrey, with such an increase in demand, tell me about the importance of psychiatrists looking after their own mental health.
Thanks for asking about that, Sam. It's something we've been terribly concerned about, and we're wearing another hat in a role I didn't mention to you. I'm the leader for the doctors union in the ACT. It's something we've been very concerned about, that people have had experience of moral injury and burnout because, coming back to the economic lens, they've been asked to stretch across too many roles, and their dedicated doctors, all healthcare workers, come in every day to help people. And the problem is with that is that they can stretch too far and they can be injured in the workplace as a result, either through psychological or physical injuries. And sometimes in our field, unfortunately, both, because sometimes people are unwell and or violent as a result of their illness. So this toll has been quite exacting, and we're facing workforce shortages that are probably more marked in the mental health care and psychiatric care sector than in many of the other fields. Though if I look with my union hat on, we're facing workforce shortages all around in the public sector hospitals. And then we've got the added problem that people need help and they're not able to access the GPs because of the changes to payroll tax and other costs that affect the business viability of general practices. General practices are private enterprises that provide high quality care, and they can no longer function adequately with the existing system, which is why one of the reasons we've argued is modernised Medicare.
So you're speaking from the perspective of Canberra, one of the wealthiest cities in the country, and you're telling me that even in Canberra there's a shortage of GPs and such an incredible difficulty in accessing them, that front door of the system. Is that what you're saying?
Practices are closing down because they can no longer operate in the current fiscal environment, and that's as a consequence of decisions which are beyond my pay grade, but part of the significant reasons why we support our colleagues in general practice is that Medicare needs to be modernized because it's not fit for purpose to reimburse patients who want to see their GP for an adequate depth of consultation, and also to address mental health issues, which GPs are expert in. They handle most of the general, milder to moderate, and of course the severe, because they have to refer the severe to private or public psychiatrists.
And I understand patients may also not be able to afford to go to a psychiatrist because of those high out-of-pocket costs. We know that those out-of-pocket costs for psychiatrists are considerably higher, and that's affecting some of the more disadvantaged people in society.
What people value in terms of their care varies from person to person. So some high-income people choose not to access services, whereas some people in lower incomes don't have the funds to access services that they want. And the problem with the out-of-pocket costs is because of the problems with the failure to modernize and keep up to date the reimbursement that belongs with the patient. So the Medicare reimbursements belong with patients, and patients have been shortchanged for nearly 30 years because the indexation of the reimbursements is well below CPI, the Consumer Price Index. So it's well below living costs. Now it's massively under.
Yeah, I can hear the passion in your voice. And Jeffrey, can I ask on a more personal note, why did you choose to become a psychiatrist?
Well, I've always been interested in the stories of people's lives and in history and mythology and also culture. Because when I was younger as a school student, I was actually a short story writer and very interested in media and magazines. But this is a very ancient era when we used to lay things out on documents with rulers and it's way before desktop publishing. And so I've always been interested in the stories and lives of people. And that's what we deal with in psychiatry. Our role, and our only role, is to assist people with their mental illness. And we have to listen to them, understand their perspective, what they think is going on wrong in their lives that may contribute to that, or they may not be any factors. They may have been bullied by their boss in the workplace. They may be in a dispute with somebody in the family. So there are social causes. There are also illnesses that people have, like schizophrenia, that affect how people view the world. But we have to understand their worldview and work with them, because it isn't our life to live as a healthcare worker. Our job and only job is to help facilitate better living for them within what is safe for them and other people. I'm not talking about paternalism, but we have to take care that we work with them to try and work out their best interests. We don't need to determine that, and also that to support if there's risks for other people. So like if children are at risk, of course, all healthcare workers have to intervene to protect children because they can't look after themselves.
And can I ask a bit more about how much of a privilege it is? Because you've really got this window into other people's lives. You've got this perspective, perhaps for an hour each week, hearing about someone else's lives, deep diving into the big issues they're facing.
Yeah, it's an immense privilege to work with people in psychiatry. And it's also a compact of trust that we keep things in confidence, because often people, nearly every week when I see people, someone says to me, "I've told you something I've never told anyone in my life." And that is a immense vote of trust, and also signals the responsibility we have to hold their feelings and their thoughts and their experiences in trust. So the other way I would say it is that it's also immensely inspiring to see that people survive through so many different adversities, and they also navigate so many challenges and try to have a good quality of life. And that's part of what we try to do to work with them. So I think both the privilege, but it's also inspiring. And one of my earliest classmates from university, his father, who was a teacher of a unusually broad perspectives, said it better than I could. He said, "Psychiatry, such a great job. You're helping people live better lives."
Yes, it's interesting how people give us these nuggets of information and then we carry them on in our lives. Let me take you to what you were talking about earlier and the shortage of psychiatrists. What are some of the potential barriers that are stopping trainee doctors choosing psychiatry? And what's perhaps a couple of myths that they might have in their mind about the profession?
Yeah, I think the biggest myth about psychiatry is almost that Hollywood or historical stereotype that it's older to middle-aged man with a beard wearing a tweed suit with leather protectors on the arms. Psychiatry is probably, aside from general practice, one of the most diverse fields in specialized medicine. We have people from a very broad spectrum of cultural and linguistic backgrounds, but also from diverse identities. And that's part of the immense richness. It often attracts people that are interested in understanding other people's views and caring and supporting people who live all the variety of lives that we try to support in a modern society. That's not to say that we don't have a cultural awareness that's important. Most of the work that we do is within a westernized environment in Australia. So we have to understand that sometimes we need help to understand someone's perspective, that we can't necessarily just apply a standard medical scientific model, because we need to be able to translate it in terms that somebody can understand and adapt, as we, as all good doctors do. We adapt the therapy to the person, not the other way around.
And that must be reassuring for people in Australia, seeing someone who reflects their identity or their culture or their background and reflecting that back to them in the psychiatry treatment room.
Yeah, I think that that's a key role, and we encourage diversity in training. But as you said, the things that are sort of push factors away from the profession, they're still heavily stigmatized, both in public society, the community, and particularly in portrayal in Hollywood. For better or worse, in most westernized modern societies, the society and legislators and have decided to give certain responsibilities to psychiatrists that most doctors don't generally have to apply. That is to recognize when somebody is so ill that they can be forcibly detained for care. And that probably is the source of the most opprobrium for that in even in Australia, that the fact that you can legally deprive someone of what seems to be their natural rights because they are ill and they don't necessarily have to agree with you. But it is determined by law in each state and by a mental health tribunal that isn't staffed solely by doctors. There's legislators and there's legal representatives and there's patient advocates.
Yes, you raise a very interesting ethical question there, and you raise a good point about privileges, perhaps of being in the psychiatry profession and that power that you have that you can exercise in these very unique circumstances.
Yeah, and I think that we have to treat that with all seriousness, because our job is to serve the community. And I've even seen various mental health legislation in various states, some of, well, perhaps I'll keep them nameless, where they've stated that psychiatrists are not to detain people because of political affiliation. That did in fact happen and continues to happen in some totalitarian countries. That is not the practice in Australia, but that's still something that people are concerned about. And so we have to take all their concerns seriously. I think the important thing, and I'm going to steal a line from something that we've sent in to, but I didn't say it, is a very unusual man called Baltasar Gracian, who was a Jesuit priest. Unfortunately, I think, and I'm not a proper historian, but what I read was that he was excommunicated because he was too much of a free thinker for the Vatican. And he said, the art of medicine lies in knowing what not to do. And what not to do means respecting the wishes of patients and protecting patients' wishes and their caring for their families as the utmost. It's a hard task, but it's one that we always have to keep paramount.
Professor Louis, Jeffrey, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Sam.
Associate Professor Louis is a clinical academic psychiatrist. He is also head of the Academic Unit of Psychiatry and Addiction Medicine at the Australian National University's School of Medicine and Psychology in Canberra. He is also on the Federal Council of the AMA as the psychiatrist representative. You can listen to more podcasts from the Medical Journal of Australia on our website at mja.com.au or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks very much for listening.